She fitted in her new inquiries around her other work with a calm efficiency that left Sparks feeling soothed and slightly inadequate. She had a way of swishing into and out of his office in minutes with the right document, question answered and action agreed, barely rippling the surface of his concentration. He began to believe they would find a new lead. But this new feeling of hope distracted him, made him reckless, and his guard relaxed. Discovery of his parallel investigation was probably inevitable. He'd left the door of the cabinet propped open while he made a call, when D.I. Downing put her head around his door without knocking. Her invitation to share a sandwich never came. She found herself confronted with the alternative Bella Elliott case, pasted up like something from a serial killer's lair. "Jude, it's just something left over from the original case," he said, seeing the hardening of his colleague's eyes. It sounded feeble even to him, and there was nothing more to be done to head off the disaster. There was sympathy rather than a tirade, and that was worse somehow.
"You need some time off, Bob,"
Chief Superintendent Parker told him firmly at their formal interview the following day.
"And some help. We recommend counselling. We have some excellent people."
Sparks tried not to laugh. He took the printed sheet of names and 2 weeks' leave, calling Salmon from his car to tell her.
"Don't go near the case again, Salmon. They know you're not going mad and won't be so gentle next time. We have to leave it with a new team."
"Understood," she said sharply. She was obviously in with someone senior, he thought.
"Call me when you can talk," he said.
Chapter 30. The Mother. Tuesday, September 16th, 2008. Dawn had made an effort. She'd bought an expensive jacket and put on a pair of heels with new tights and a skirt. The editor made a huge fuss over her, meeting her at the lifts and walking her through the newsroom in front of all the reporters. They smiled and nodded from behind their computer terminals, and the man who had sat in court every day put down his phone and came over to shake her hand. The editor's secretary, an impossibly elegant woman with magazine-standard hair and makeup, followed them into the inner sanctum and asked if she wanted a tea or a coffee. "Tea, please. No sugar." A tray arrived and the small talk ended. The editor was a busy man.
"Now then, Dawn, let's talk about our campaign to bring Taylor to justice. We'll need a big interview with you to launch it, and a new angle."
Dawn Elliott knew exactly what the editor wanted. Years of media exposure had toughened her up. A new angle meant more space on the front page, follow-ups in all the other papers, breakfast TV interviews, Radio 5 Live, Woman's Hour, magazines. Like night follows day. It was exhausting, but she had to keep going, because most days she knew, really knew, deep inside her, that her baby was still alive. And on the other days, she hoped. But sitting on a sky blue foam cube, a corporate decorator's attempt to humanize the space, becalmed in the air-conditioned office, she also knew that this newspaper wanted her to say for the first time that Bella had been murdered. It would be the belter of a story, the editor required to go after Glenn Taylor.
"I'm not saying Bella is dead, Mark," she said, "because she isn't."
Mark Perry nodded, his faux sympathy stiffening his face, and pressed on.
"Look, I completely understand. But it's difficult to accuse someone of murder, Dawn, if we're saying that his victim is still alive. I know how hard this must be, but the police believe Bella is dead, don't they?"
"Bob Sparks doesn't," she replied.
"He does, Dawn. Everybody does."
In the silence that followed, Dawn struggled with her options.
please the papers, or go it alone. She talked to the PR advising the campaign on pro bono terms earlier that morning, and he'd warned she'd face Sophie's Choice.
Once you say that Bella is dead, there's no going back, and the danger is that the search for her will stop.
That couldn't happen. I think we should keep the question open, Dawn said. Why don't we stick with accusing him of the kidnapping? When I find her, you won't want to be the paper that said she was dead. Everyone will say that you stopped people from looking for her.
Perry walked to his desk and came back with one of the A3 sheets of paper covering his desk. He shifted the tray to another cube and laid the sheet on the table. It was the mock-up of a front page, one of several drawn to sell the Herald's exclusive. There were no stories cluttering the page, just seven words screaming, "This is the man who stole Bella," and a photograph of Glenn Taylor. Perry had favoured the headline, "Killer," but that would have its day when they nailed the bastard.
"What about this?" he asked, and Dawn picked it up and scrutinised it like a pro.
In the beginning, she could hardly bear to look at Taylor's face, seeing it beside the face of her baby in every paper. But she'd forced herself. She looked at his eyes, searching for guilt. Looked at his mouth, looking for weakness or lust. But there was nothing there. He looked like a man she might sit next to on a bus or stand behind in a supermarket queue. And she wondered if she ever had. Was that why he'd picked her child?
It was a question that reverberated through every waking minute. Her dreams were full of Bella, glimpses of her just out of reach, being unable to move or make any progress toward her child, no matter how hard she ran. And on waking, realizing, as if for the first time, that she was gone. At first, she was unable to take part in any sort of life. She was so overwhelmed by failure and helplessness. But when eventually she'd surfaced from the sedatives, her mum had persuaded her to fill her days with practical things.
"You need to get up. Get dressed every day and do something, Dawn, even something small."
It was the same advice she'd given when Bella was born, when Dawn struggled to cope with the sleep deprivation and the colicky screaming of her new baby. And she got up and got dressed. She'd walked down the path to the gate. She'd stood in the garden, like Bella had, and looked out at the world passing by. The Find Bella campaign had begun on Dawn's Facebook page, with her posting something about Bella, or how she was feeling most days. The response was like a tidal wave, swamping her and then buoying her up. She gathered thousands, then hundreds of thousands of friends and likes as mothers and fathers all over the world reached out to her. It had given her something to focus on, and when people with money contacted her to offer cash to help find her little girl, she'd said yes. Bob Sparks had admitted he had reservations about some of the directions taken by the Find Bella campaign, but said it was okay as long as his officers weren't being diverted from the task in hand.
"Still, you never know," he told her. "The campaign might shame someone into coming forward."
"Kate will go mad when she sees I've gone with the Herald." "The enemy," she told herself when first approached. "But her lot didn't match the offer on the table. She'll see the sense." In truth, she wished it would be Kate and Terry handling the story, but the Daily Post had passed on the opportunity. It was hard, because she got close to Kate over the months. They talked most weeks and met up every so often for lunch and a gossip. Sometimes the paper would send a car to bring Dawn to London for the day. And in return, Dawn told Kate everything first. but the Post's coverage had petered out recently. "Is the paper bored with me?" she'd asked Kate at their last meeting, when an interview failed to appear. "Don't be daft," the reporter had said. "There's just quite a lot of other stuff happening at the moment." But Kate hadn't been able to meet her eye. Dawn was no longer the lost girl on the sofa. She understood. And when the Herald called her to propose a campaign to bring Taylor to justice and a generous donation to the Find Bella Fund, she'd accepted it. She'd rung Kate to let her know her decision. She owed her that. The call sent the reporter into a blind panic. "Christ, Dawn, are you serious? Have you signed anything?" "No, I'm going to see them this afternoon." "Okay, give me 20 minutes. "Well, please, Dawn." When the reporter rang back, Dawn knew immediately that Kate was empty-handed. "I'm sorry, Dawn. They won't do it. They think it's too risky to accuse Taylor, and they're right. It's a stunt, Dawn, and could blow up in your face. Don't do it." Dawn sighed. "I'm sorry too, Kate. You know it's not personal. You've been brilliant. But I can't stop now just because one paper has lost interest." "Better go, or I'll be late. Let's speak soon." And here she was, looking through the contract and rechecking the subclauses for loopholes. Her lawyer had already read it, but had advised her to take another look, in case they slipped something new in. Mark Perry watched her, nodding encouragingly whenever she spoke and smiling broadly when she signed and dated the document. "Okay, let's get started," he said, standing and propelling her out of the office to the waiting feature writer who would do the big interview. The paper had thousands of words already written, prepared for the expected guilty verdict. Before Glenn Taylor's trial, they'd interviewed former colleagues from the bank and delivery firm, collected the sordid tales of the chatroom women, and had the child porn confirmed in an off-the-record briefing by a detective on the team. They'd also bought up a neighbour of the Taylors, paying her for her exclusive photos of Taylor with her kids, one of them a little blonde girl. The neighbour had told her story about him watching the children from a window and how she'd nailed up the gate between their houses. None of it would go to waste now. "She won't go for the killer headline, but we've got a great first day," he told his deputy, slipping his jacket on the back of a chair on the back bench and rolling up his sleeves. "Let's work on the editorial and get the lawyers up here. Don't fancy prison just yet." The Herald splashed the story over the first 9 pages, pledging to bring Glenn Taylor to justice and demanding that the Home Secretary order a retrial. It was journalism at its most powerful, hammering home the message with a mallet, inciting reaction, and the readers responded. The comment sections on the website were filled with unthinking, screaming vitriol, foul-mouthed opinion, and calls for the death penalty to be reinstated. "The usual natters," the news editor summed up in morning conference. "But lots of them." "Let's show a bit of respect for our readers," the editor said. And they all laughed. "Now, what have we got for today?"
Chapter 31. The Reporter. Wednesday, September 17th, 2008. Kate Waters fumed over her desk breakfast. "We could have had this," she told anyone who would listen as she turned the pages of the Herald. Across the newsroom, Terry Deacon heard but carried on typing his news list. She abandoned her brown toast and honey and walked over. "We could have had this," she repeated, standing over him.
"Of course we could, Kate, but she wanted too much money, and we've already had 3 big interviews with her."
He pushed back his chair and looked pained.
Honestly, what is new here? Wouldn't have minded the pictures with the kids next door, but the internet sluts and the child porn have been everywhere.
That's not the point, Terry. The Herald is now the official Bella Elliott paper. If Taylor is retried and found guilty, they'll be able to say they brought Bella's kidnapper to justice. Where will we be? Standing on the steps with our dicks in our hands.
Find a better story then, Kate,
the editor said as he suddenly appeared behind them.
Don't waste time on this old rehash. Off to a marketing meeting, but let's talk later.
Okay, Simon, she said to his retreating back.
Bloody hell, you've been summoned to the headmaster's study, Terry said, and laughed once his boss was out of earshot.
Kate returned to her seat and cold toast and began searching for the elusive better story. In normal circumstances, she'd just ring Dawn or Bob Sparks, but her options were vanishing fast. Dawn had decamped, and Bob had mysteriously disappeared off the radar for weeks. She'd heard from the crime man that there'd been a bit of row over interference in the Bella review, and Sparks's phone seemed to be permanently off. She gave it another try and gave a silent cheer when it rang. "Hello, Bob," she said when Sparks finally answered. "How are you? Are you back at work yet? Guess you've seen the Herald."
"Hi, Kate. Yes. Quite a bold step for them, given the verdict. Hope they've got good lawyers. Anyway, good to hear from you. I'm fine. Had a bit of a break, but back at work. I'm in town working with the Met, tidying some loose ends. Up near you, actually.
Well, what are you doing for lunch today?" He was sitting in the expensive, tiny French restaurant when she walked in, dark suit and black mood stark against the white tablecloths.
"Bob, you look well," she lied.
"Sorry if I'm late. Traffic." He rose and offered his hand across the table. "Just got here myself." The small talk stopped and started as a waiter brought menus, offered suggestions and water, hovered for the order, and poured the wine. But finally, with matching plates of Magrette de Canard in front of them, she began in earnest.
"I want to help, Bob," she said, picking up her fork. "There must be some line of inquiry we can look at again."
He didn't speak but sawed at the rosy meat in front of him. She waited.
"Look, Kate, we made a mistake and can't unmake it. Let's see what the Herald's campaign produces. Do you think he'll sue?"
"It's a dangerous game, suing for libel," she said. "I've been there. If he does, he's got to go in the witness box and give evidence. Will he really want to do that?"
"He's a clever man, Kate. Slippery."
He was rolling the crumbs of the bread into beads of dough between his fingers.
"I don't know any more."
"For goodness sake, Bob, you're a fantastic copper. Why are you giving up?" He raised his head and looked at her. "Sorry, didn't mean to nag. I just hate seeing you like this," she said. In the lull, while both sipped their wine, Kate cursed her haste. "Leave the poor man alone," she thought. But she couldn't. It was not in her nature.
"So what have you been doing with the Met today?"
"Loose ends, like I said. Sorting through some stuff from a couple of joint investigations, car theft, that sort of thing. Actually, there were also some bits and pieces left over from the Bella case, early stuff when we first picked up Glenn Taylor."
"Anything interesting?" she asked.
"No, not really. The Met went to make sure the other quick delivery driver was at home while we drove up from Southampton."
"What other driver?"
"There were two drivers in Hampshire that day, you know that."
She didn't, or she hadn't remembered.
"The other one was a bloke called Mike Doonan. He was the one we went to see first. Perhaps his name didn't come out at the time. Anyway, he's crippled with a crumbling spine, could hardly walk, and we never found anything to pursue."
"Did you question him?"
"Yes. He was the one who told us Taylor was also making a delivery in the area that day. Not sure we'd have found that out without him. Taylor did the drop as a favour, so there's no official record of it.
The case review team went to see him too. Nothing added, apparently. Kate excused herself from the table and went to the ladies where she scribbled down the name and put a quick call in to a colleague to find an address for Doonan, for later. When she got back to the table, the detective was putting his credit card back in his wallet. "Bob, I invited you," she said. He waved away her protest and smiled. "My pleasure. It's been good to see you, Kate. Thanks for your pep talk." She deserved that, she thought, as they walked out in single file. On the pavement, he shook her hand again, and they both went back to work. Kate's phone began vibrating as she hailed a taxi, and she waved away the cab to take the call. "There's a Michael Doonan in Peckham, according to the electoral roll. I'll text the address and the names of the neighbours," the crime man said. "You're a star, thanks," she said, raising her hand for another taxi. Her phone rang again almost immediately. "Kate, where the hell are you? We've got an interview with the ex-wife of that footballer. It's up near Leeds, so get on the next train and I'll email you the background. Ring when you're at the station."
Chapter 32. The Widow. Wednesday, September 17th, 2008. Someone put the Herald through the door today. The day they accused Glenn all over again. And he put it straight in the bin. I got it out and hid it away behind the bleach under the sink for later. We'd known it was coming, because the Herald had been banging on the door the day before, shouting questions and pushing notes through the letterbox. They said they were campaigning for a retrial, so that Bella would get justice. "What about justice for me?" Glenn said. "It's a blow, but Tom phoned to say the paper will have to have deep pockets to pay the costs, and most importantly, they have no evidence. He said to batten down the hatches, whatever that means. The Herald are coming at us with all guns blazing, but it is all just sensationalism and tittle-tattle," he told Glenn, who repeated it line by line to me. "He talks like it is a war," I say, and then shut up. "The weight will be worse than the reality," Tom predicts, and I hope he's right. "We've got to keep quiet, Jeannie," Glenn explains. "Tom will start legal proceedings against the paper, but he thinks we should go on a bit of a holiday, remove ourselves from the picture, until this all blows over. I'll go online and book something this morning. He hasn't asked where I want to go, and to be honest, I don't care. My little helpers are beginning to have less effect, and I feel so tired I could cry. In the end, he picks somewhere in France. In my other life, I would have been thrilled, but I'm not sure what I feel when he tells me he's found a cottage in the countryside that's miles from anywhere. Our flight leaves at 7 tomorrow morning, so we need to leave here at 4, Jeannie. Let's get packed up, and we'll take our car. Don't want a taxi driver tipping off the press. He knows so much, my Glenn. Thank God I've got him to look after me." At the airport, we keep our heads down and sunglasses on, and we wait until the queue is almost down to the last person before we head to the desk. The woman checking us in barely looks at us and sends our suitcase onto the conveyor belt before she's managed to say, "Did you pack this bag yourself?" let alone waited to hear the answer. I'd forgotten how much queuing there was in airports, and we are so stressed by the time we get to the gate that I am ready to go home to the press pack. "Come on, love," Glenn says, holding my hand as we walk to the plane. "Nearly there." At Bergerac, he goes to get the rental car while I wait for the bag, mesmerized by the passing luggage. I miss our case. It's been so long since we used it. I've forgotten what color it is, and have to wait until everyone else has heaved theirs off. I finally go out into the bright sunshine and spot Glenn in a tiny red car. "Didn't think it would be worth getting anything bigger," he says. "We're not going to do much driving, are we?" Funny, but being on our own in France is different from being on our own at home. Without a routine, we don't know what to say to each other, so we say nothing. The silence should be a rest from the constant noise and banging on our door at home. But it isn't. It's worse somehow. I take to going for long walks in the lanes and woods around the cottage, while Glenn sits on a sun lounger and reads detective novels. I could scream when I see what he's packed, as if we hadn't had enough of police investigations. I decide to leave him with his perfect murders and sit on the other side of the patio with some magazines. I find myself looking at Glenn, watching him and thinking about him. If he looks up and catches me, I pretend I am looking at something behind him. I am, I suppose. I don't really know what I am looking for. Some sign of something. His innocence. The toll taken by the ordeal. The real man, perhaps. I can't really say. The only time we leave the place is to drive to the nearest supermarket to get food and loo rolls. I can't be bothered to shop for real meals. Finding the stuff to go into a spaghetti bolognese is beyond me. So we eat bread and ham and cheese at lunchtime, and a cold roast chicken and coleslaw, or more ham in the evenings. We aren't really hungry anyway. It is just something to push around our plates. We've been here 4 days when I think I see someone walking along the lane at the bottom of the property. First person I've seen near the property. A car is an event. I don't think much of it, but the next morning there's a man walking up the drive. Glenn, I shout to him in the house. There's a bloke coming up. Get in here, Jean, he hisses, and I hurry past him as he closes the door and begins drawing the curtains. We wait for the knock. The Herald has found us. Found us and photographed us. The kidnapper and his wife sunning themselves outside their exclusive hideaway in the Dordogne, while Dawn Elliot desperately continues her search for her child. Tom reads us the headlines the next day over the phone. We're only here because we're being hounded, Tom, I say. And Glenn has been cleared by the courts. I know, Jean, but the papers have convened their own court. It won't last long before they'll be on to the next thing. They're like children, easily distracted. He says the Herald must have traced Glenn's credit card to find us. Are they allowed to do that, I ask? No, but that doesn't stop them. I put down the phone and begin packing. The villains again. When we get home, they are waiting. And Glenn rings Tom to talk about how to stop them from saying these things. It's libel, Jeannie. Tom says we have to sue them, or threaten to sue them. Or they'll keep going, digging into our lives and putting us on the front page. I want it to stop, so I agree. Glenn knows best. It takes a while for the solicitors to write their letter. They have to say why the stories are all wrong. And that takes a bit of time. Glenn and I go up to Holborn again, taking the same train I used to take when he was on trial. Groundhog Day, he says to me. He tries to keep my spirits up, and I love him for it. The barrister isn't a Charles Sanderson. He's a real smooth character. I bet his wig isn't falling apart. He looks rich, like he drives a sports car and has a country house. And his office is all shiny metal and glass. Libel is obviously the money-making end of the business. Wonder if Mr. Sanderson knows. This one is all business. He's as bad as the prosecutor, asking all the questions again and again. I squeeze Glenn's hand to show him I'm on his side, and he squeezes back. The smoothie pushes and pushes on every detail. I have to test our case, Mr. Taylor, because this is basically a rerun of the Bella Elliott prosecution. That case was thrown out because of the police actions, but the Herald maintains you kidnapped the child. We say that is wrong and defamatory. However, the Herald will throw everything at you, from the case itself, and they can also use evidence they gathered that was not admissible in the criminal trial, do you see? We must have looked a bit blank, because Tom began to explain it in simple language, while the smoothie looked out at the view. They'll have a lot of dirt, Glenn, and they'll throw all of it at you to get the libel jury on their side. We need to show that you're innocent, Glenn, to get the jury to find against the Herald. I am, he says, all fired up. We know, but we need to show it, and we need to be sure there are no surprises. Just saying, Glenn. You need to go into this with your eyes open, because it's a very expensive action to bring. It will cost thousands of pounds. Glenn looks at me, and I try to look brave, but inside I'm running for the door. I suppose we've got the dirty money we can use. No surprises, Mr. Taylor, the smoothie repeats. None, Glenn says. I look at my lap. The letter goes out the next day, and the Herald shouts about it all over its pages and on the radio and television. Taylor tries to gag Herald, is the headline. I hate the word gag.
Chapter 33. The Mother. Friday, September 26, 2008. The photographs of the Taylors in France made Dawn furious. "Is furious," she wrote in her Facebook status, with a link to the main picture of Glenn Taylor in shorts and bare-chested, lying on a lounger, reading a thriller called The Book of the Dead. The crassness of it made her want to go around and shake the truth out of him. She cooked the idea in her head all morning, playing the scene over and over of her bringing Taylor to his knees and him crying and begging forgiveness. She was so sure it would work, she rang Mark Perry at the Herald and demanded a confrontation between her and the kidnapper. "I could go to his house. I could look him in the eye. He might confess," she said, high on the fear and excitement of meeting her child's abductor. Perry hesitated, not from any compunction about accusing Taylor. He was writing the headline in his mind as he listened. But he wanted the dramatic confrontation to be exclusive, and the doorstep was far too public. "He might not open the door, Dawn," he said, "and then we'll be left standing there. We need to do it where he can't hide, in the street when he's not expecting us. We'll find out when he's next meeting with the lawyers and catch him as he goes in. Just us, Dawn." She understood and told no one. She knew her mum would try to dissuade her. "He's scum, Dawn. He's not going to confess in the street. It'll just upset you and bring you down again. Let the courts get it out of him." But Dawn didn't want to listen to sense. She didn't want advice. She wanted to act, to do something for Bella. She didn't have to wait long. "You won't believe this, Dawn. He's got an early morning appointment next Thursday, on the anniversary of Bella's disappearance," Perry said on the phone. "It'll be perfect." Dawn couldn't speak for a moment. There was nothing perfect about the anniversary. It had been looming over the horizon, and the terrible dreams had increased. She found herself reenacting the days leading up to October 2nd. Shopping trips, walking to nursery school, watching Bella's DVDs. 2 years without her little girl seemed like a lifetime. Perry was still talking, and she tuned back in, trying to reach back to her anger. "Taylor likes to go when no one else is around, apparently, so we'll have him to ourselves. Come in, and we'll plan our MO."
"What's an MO?"
"It's Latin for how we're going to get Glenn Taylor."
Every eventuality was covered during the conference in the editor's office. Arrival by taxi? Check. Arrival by public transport? Check. Back entrances? Check. Timings? Check. Dawn's hiding place? Check. Dawn sat and received her orders. She was to sit in a black cab down the street from the barrister's chambers and jump out at a signal from the reporter. 2 rings on her mobile, then out. "You'll probably have time for only 2 questions, Dawn," Tim, the chief reporter, advised. "So make them short and to the point."
"I just want to ask, where's my daughter? That's all."
The editor and assembled journalists exchanged glances. This was going to be fantastic. On the day, Dawn was not dressed too smartly, as instructed.
"You don't want to look like a TV reporter in the photos," Tim had said. "You want to look like the grieving mother."
He added quickly, "Like you, Dawn." She was collected by the office driver and delivered to the meeting point, a cafe in High Holborn. Tim, two other reporters, two photographers, and a video journalist were already around a formica table, smeared plates stacked in the middle.
"Already?" he said, trying not to show too much excitement.
"Yes, Tim, I'm ready." As she sat in the cab with him later, her nerve began to fail. But he kept her talking about the campaign, keeping her anger ticking over. The mobile rang twice. "We're on, Dawn," he said, picking up the copy of the Herald she would thrust in Taylor's face and cracking open the door. She could see them coming down the street. Glenn Taylor and Jean, his simpering wife. And she stepped clear of the cab, her legs shaking. The street was quiet. The office staff who would eventually fill the buildings were still jammed together on the underground. She stood in the middle of the pavement and watched them get nearer. Her stomach knotted, but the couple failed to notice her until they were only 100 feet away. Jean Taylor was fussing over her husband's briefcase, trying to stuff documents back in, when she looked up and stopped dead.
"Glenn," she said loudly. "It's her, Bella's mother."
Glenn Taylor focused on the woman in the street.
"Christ, Jean, it's an ambush. You say nothing, no matter what she says," he hissed, and took hold of her arm to propel her through to the doorway.
"Where is my daughter? Where's Bella?"
Dawn screamed into his face, spittle from the bee landing near his mouth. Taylor looked Dawn in the face for a fraction of a second, and then was gone behind dead eyes.
"Where is she, Glenn?"
Dawn repeated, trying to catch his arm and shake him. The cameramen had appeared and were capturing every second, circling the trio to get the best shots while the reporters barked questions, separating Jean Taylor from her husband, and leaving her stranded like a stray sheep. Dawn suddenly wheeled on Jean.
"What has he done with my baby, Mrs. Taylor? What has your husband done with her?"
"He's done nothing. He's innocent. The court said so," Jean screamed back, shocked into a response by the violence of the attack.
"Where's my child?"
Dawn shouted again, unable to ask anything else.
"We don't know," Jean yelled back.
"Why did you leave your little girl alone so someone could take her? That's what people should be asking."
"That's enough, Jean,"
Taylor said, and pushed past the cameras, pulling her along in his wake as Tim comforted Dawn.
"She said it was my fault," she breathed, her face ashen.
"She's a nasty bitch, Dawn. Only she and the Nutters think it's your fault. Come on, let's get you back to the paper for the interview." "This is going to look great," he thought, as they travelled through the traffic to West London.
Dawn stood beside one of the pillars to watch as the photographs were laid out along the whole length of the back bench so the newsroom could look and admire.
"Fucking brilliant shots of Glenn Taylor. That look he gave Dawn is chilling," the picture editor said as he hawked his wares.
"We'll put it on the front," Perry said. "Page 3, Dawn in tears, and Jean Taylor shouting at her like a fishwife. Not the mousy little woman after all. Look at the fury in that face. Now, where are the words?" "The kidnapper and the mother," blared out of the front page the next morning on trains, buses, and at Britain's breakfast tables. Tim, the chief reporter, rang to congratulate her.
"Great job, Dawn. Would love to be a fly on the wall at the tailor's this morning."
He didn't tell her that the editor was delirious, or that the Herald's sales were up, as was the editor's annual bonus.
Chapter 34 The Widow Thursday, October 2nd, 2008 I was shaking when we got into the lawyers. Not sure if it was anger or nerves. Bit of both, probably. And even Mr. Smoothie put his arm around me. Bloody stunt merchants, he said to Tom Payne. We should report their behaviour to the press council. I kept replaying it in my head from the moment I realised it was her. I should have recognised her straight away. I've seen her enough times on the telly and in court. But it's different when you see someone in the street, where you're not expecting them to be. You don't really look at people's faces, I think, just their outlines. Of course, as soon as I really looked at her, I knew it was her. Dawn Elliott, the mother, standing there with the idiots from the Herald egging her on, accusing my Glenn when he's been found not guilty. It's not right. It's not fair. I suppose it was the shock that made me shout at her like that. Glenn was angry that I told her what I thought. It'll just keep everyone going, Jean. She'll feel she has to defend herself and keep giving interviews. I told you to keep quiet. I said I was sorry, but I wasn't. I meant every word said to Dawn Elliott. I'll do a phone in tonight and say it again. It felt good to say it out loud in public. People should know it's all her fault. She was responsible for our little girl, and she let her get taken. They sat me down with a hot drink in the clerk's room while they got on with the meeting. I wasn't in the mood for legal stuff anyway, so I sat quietly in a corner, replaying the row in the street in my head and sort of listening to the secretary's chatter. Invisible again. It took ages for the meeting to end, and then we had to discuss how we were going to get out without the press seeing us. In the end, we went out the back, down an alleyway, where they put the bins and bikes. They won't be hanging around now, but no point taking chances, Tom said. It'll be on their website by now, and all over the paper tomorrow. It'll increase the damages. Just keep thinking about the money. Glenn shook Tom's hand, and I just sort of waved. I didn't want the money. I wanted it to stop. He was extra nice to me when we got in, taking my coat off and making me sit with my feet up while he put the kettle on. It was the anniversary today. I'd marked it in my diary with a dot. A little dot that could be a slip of the pen, so no one else would know if they looked. 2 years since she was taken. They'd never find her now. The people who took her must have persuaded everyone by now that she was theirs, and she must have accepted them as her mum and dad. She's little, and she probably hardly remembers her real mother. I hope she's happy, and they love her as much as I would, if she were here with me. For a moment I could see her sitting on our stairs, bumping down on her bottom and laughing, calling for me to come and watch her. She could have been here if Glenn had brought her home to me. Glenn hadn't said much since we got back. He'd got his computer on his knee and closed it quickly when I went to sit next to him. What were you looking at, love? I asked. Just flicking through the sports pages, he said, and then went to put petrol in the car. I picked up the computer and opened it. It said it was locked, and I sat and stared at the screen. At the photo of me Glenn had put on it. There I was, locked, like the computer. When he came home, I tried to talk to him about the future. Why don't we move, Glenn? Have the fresh start we keep talking about. We're never going to escape this unless we do. We're not moving, Jean, he snapped at me. This is our home, and I won't be driven out of it. We're going to weather this, together. The press will forget about us in the end and move on to some other poor sod. They won't, I wanted to say. Every anniversary of Bella's disappearance, every time a child goes missing, every time there is a quiet news day, they'll come back, and we'll just be sitting here waiting. There are so many nice places to live, Glenn. We've talked about living by the sea one day. We could do that now. We could even move abroad. Abroad? What the hell are you talking about? I don't want to live somewhere I can't speak the language. I'm staying put. So we did. We might as well have moved to a desert island in the end, as we were completely isolated in our little house. Just the sharks circling occasionally. We kept each other company, doing the crossword together in the kitchen, him reading out the clues and writing the answers in, while I was still guessing, watching films together in the living room, me learning to knit, him chewing his nails, like an old retired couple. I'm not even 40 yet. I think the Mannings' poodle must have died. It's been weeks since any dog shit has been left on the doorstep, Glenn said conversationally. It was very old. The graffiti persisted. That paint is terrible to get off, and neither of us wanted to stand there in full view scrubbing at it, so it stayed. Scum and paedophile, in big red letters on the garden wall. Kids, Glenn said, from the local comprehensive, if the spelling's anything to go by. There were letters from the hate mail brigade most weeks, but we'd started putting them straight in the bin. You could tell them a mile off. I never saw those tiny envelopes or the green pens they used for sale. The poisonous people must have had their own source of them and the rough lined notepaper they preferred. I supposed it must be cheap. I used to look at the handwriting to try to guess what sort of person had sent it. Some were all loops and swirls, the sort of writing on a wedding invitation, and I thought they must have been written by old people. No one else wrote like that anymore. They were not all anonymous. Some wrote their address in spidery writing on the top, lovely names like Rose Cottage or The Willows, and then spewed out their bile underneath. I was so tempted to write back and tell them what I thought of them, to give them a dose of their own medicine. I wrote the replies in my head when I was pretending to watch the television, but I didn't take it any further. It would have caused trouble. They're just sick, Jeannie, Glenn said each time one plopped through the letterbox. We should feel sorry for them, really. Sometimes I wondered who they were. And then I thought, they were probably people like me and Glenn. Lonely people. People on the edge of things. Prisoners in their own homes. I bought a big jigsaw puzzle at the local charity shop. It was a picture of a beach with cliffs and seagulls. It would give me something to do in the afternoons. It was going to be a long winter.
Chapter 35. The Reporter. Friday, December 18th, 2009. It had been a quietish week. Christmas fast approaching had filled the paper with festive nonsense and warming stories of adversity overcome. Kate flicked through her notebook, more from habit than hope, but there was nothing to pick at. The paper was already full of Saturday reads, long features, shrieking columnists, pages of elaborate Christmas fare and post-festivity diets. Terry looked happy anyway. Unlike the crime man, who, passing her desk on his way to the gents, paused to vent his anger. "My Christmas anniversary piece has been chucked out," he said. "Poor you. Which one?" Kate asked. He was notorious for recycling stories. "The green bin of news," he called it cheerfully. "Bella, it's Dawn's third one without her. How about a drink at lunchtime?" "Bella... Oh, my God, I forgot you," she told the child's picture stuck on her filing cabinet. "I'm so sorry." The Herald's campaign had gone quiet once the threat of a libel action had become a reality, and both camps had drawn back behind their battle lines. Kate heard on the grapevine that the legal director of the Herald had had a stand-up row with the editor over the initial coverage, and she persuaded her rival Tim to tell her all about it over a glass or three of wine. He'd been cautious about the details at first, but the story was too good not to tell properly. He propped up the bar in a pub opposite the High Court and told her how the House lawyer had accused Mark Perry of ignoring his advice and using lurid comments and allegations in the copy. "I expect Taylor's killer eyes was one of them," Kate laughed. "I thought you were on pretty shaky ground there." "Yes, one of Perry's choicer phrases. Anyway, The lawyer said Mark was ramping up the potential damages every time he pulled a stunt like that. And Taylor's got money to fund a case. Or that compensation from the police, Kate said. The editors agree to pull back from the direct accusations and harassment, soft pedal while the libel case is pending. But he's not going to give up the campaign, is he? Kate asked. He'll definitely have to pay up if he does that. It's tantamount to admitting he's in the wrong. Tim grimaced into his Merlot. He's not happy. He hit his monitor with his fist, then crashed back into the newsroom to tell everyone they were fucking amateurs. He likes to spread the pain, cause it inclusivity. Kate had patted Tim's arm sympathetically and headed for home. As Tim had predicted, the Herald had quieted down, and the libel action appeared to have stalled in the chambers of both sides. But she was ready to have another go. She needed to find her notebook from a year ago. There, scribbled on the cover, was an address in Peckham for one Mike Doonan. "Slipping out to knock a door on a tip," she told Terry. "On my mobile if you need me." It took an age to cross Westminster Bridge and crawl down the Old Kent Road, but the cabbie finally pulled up in the shadow of a grim relic of 1960s cutting-edge architecture, a grey concrete box studded with filthy windows and satellite dishes. Kate went to the door and pressed the bell. She knew what she was going to say. She'd had plenty of time in the taxi to plan, but there was no answer. The flat echoed with the bell ringing, but it was the only sound. "He's out!" a voice called from next door. A woman's voice. "Bugger. I hoped I'd catch him in. I thought he was housebound," she replied. A head appeared out of the door. Ancient, tight perm, and an apron. "He's down at the bookies. Doesn't go out much now with his back, poor Mike. But he tries to get out once a day. Was he expecting you?" Kate smiled at the neighbour. "Not really. It was on the off chance. I'm doing a story about a man he used to work with when he was a driver. Glenn Taylor. The Bella case." The neighbour opened her door wider. "The Bella case? Did he work with that bloke? He never said. Do you want to come in and wait?" Within the first 5 minutes, Mrs. Meaden had told Kate about Doonan's medical condition. "Degenerative osteoarthritis getting steadily worse. His betting habit, ex-wives, kids, and diet. Beans on toast practically every night. Can't be good for him. I do a bit of shopping for him every week, and the kids on the estate run errands." "That's kind of you. He's lucky to have a neighbour like you." Mrs. Meaden looked pleased. "It's what any Christian would do," she said. "Tea?" Kate balanced the flowered cup and saucer on the arm of her chair and took a shop-bought mince pie out of the proffered cake tin. "Funny he never mentioned he knew this Glenn Taylor man, isn't it?" Mrs. Meaden said, brushing crumbs off her lap. "They worked together, at Quick Delivery," Kate prompted. "He drove for years. Says that's what did it for his back. He doesn't really have friends, not what I call friends, people who come and see him. He used to go to a computer place around here, said it was sort of a club. Used to go regularly before he retired. Funny thing for a man of his age to be doing, I always thought. Still, he's on his own, so he must get bored. I didn't know there was a computer club around here. Do you know what it's called?" "It's on Princess Street, I think. Shabby-looking place with blacked-out windows. Oh, there's Mike now." They could hear the heavy sound of dragging feet and the stabbing of a stick onto the concrete walkway. "Hello, Mike," Mrs. Meaden called as she opened her door. "Got a lady from the press here for you." Doonan pulled a face as Kate emerged.
"Sorry, love. My back is killing me. Can you come back another time?"
Kate moved closer to him and took his arm. "Let me at least help you in," she said, and did. The smell in Doonan's flat was nothing like the cabbage and Dettol disinfectant permeating next door, It smelled of men, sweat, old beer, stale cigarette smoke, feet.
"What do you want to talk to me for? I told the police all I knew,"
Doonan said as Kate perched on a hard chair opposite him. "Glenn Taylor," she said simply.
"Well, him."
"You used to work together," Doonan nodded. "I'm writing a profile on him, trying to get a better picture of who he really is."
"Then you've come to the wrong person. He was no friend of mine. I've told the police. Stuck-up little prick if you want to know."
"I do," she thought.
"Always thought he was better than us, slumming it until something better came along."
She had found his sore spot and scratched it. "Heard he was a bit arrogant."
"Arrogant? That's an understatement. Lorded it over us in the lunchroom with his stories of when he ran a bank. And then he got me into trouble over my back problem. Told the boss I was having them on about how bad it was. Said I was faking."
"That must have caused you problems." Doonan smiled bitterly.
"Joke of it is that I helped him get the job at Quick Delivery."
Kate pounced. "Really? So you knew him before? Where'd you come across him?"
"On the net, on a forum or something."
Doonan sounded less sure of himself. "And at the club in Princess Street?" Doonan flashed a look at Kate.
"What club?" he said. "Look, I need to take my pills. You'll have to go."
She put her business card down beside him and shook his hand. "Thanks for talking to me, Mike. I really appreciate it. I'll let myself out." She headed straight for Princess Street. The sign for Internet Inc. was small and amateurish, the shop window painted black on the inside, and there was a CCTV camera positioned over the door. "Looks like a sex shop," she thought. The door was locked, and there were no opening times posted. She walked to the greengrocer's at the top of the street and waited until one of the assistants in a Santa hat came out to serve her from the stall on the pavement. "Hi, I want to use the internet, but the place down the street is closed. Do you know when it opens?" she said, and the young man laughed.
"You don't want to go in there, love. It's for blokes."
"How do you mean?"
"Porn place, isn't it? They don't let the public in. It's a sort of club thing for dirty old men."
"Oh, right. Who runs it, then?"
"Dunno, really. Manager is an Asian bloke called Lenny, but he's open at night mainly, so we don't see him much."
"Thanks. I'll have four of those apples." She'd come back later. Internet Inc. looked even less savoury in the dark. Kate had spent 2.5 hours in a grimy pub, sipping a succession of warm fruit juices and listening to Perry Como work his magic on Frosty the Snowman. She was not in the mood for a brush-off. When she tried the door, it was still locked, but knocking on the blackened glass produced a voice from within.
"Hello, who is it?"
"I need to speak to Lenny," Kate said, looking up at the camera with her most winning smile. Silence. The door opened, and a tall, muscular man in a vest and jeans appeared.
"Do I know you?" he asked.
"Hi, you must be Lenny. I'm Kate. I wondered if I could have a quick word."
"What about?"
"About a story I'm writing."
"You're a reporter?"
Lenny slid backward into the shop.
"We've got a license. It's all legit. There's no story here."
"No, it's not about you. It's about Bella Elliott." The name was like a magic talisman. It transfixed people, drew them in.
"Bella Elliott? Little Bella?" he said. "Look, come on through to my office."
She entered a narrow, darkened room, lit only by the LED glow of a dozen computer screens. Each was in a booth with a chair. There was no other furniture, but in a nod to the season, a piece of tinsel hung limply from the central light.
"No customers yet. They usually come a bit later," Lenny explained as he led her to his cupboard of an office, the walls lined with stacks of DVDs and magazines.
Ignore those, he advised, as he caught her looking at the titles. Right, she said, and sat. You've come about Glenn Taylor, haven't you? Kate couldn't speak for a moment. He'd cut to the chase before she'd had a chance to ask her first question. Yes. I wondered when someone would finally knock on my door. Thought it'd be the police, but it's you. Did he come here? Was Glenn Taylor a member of your club? Lenny considered the questions. Look, I never talk about members. No one would come if I did. But I've got kids. Kate nodded. I understand, but I'm not interested in anyone else. Just him. Will you help me? Please. The manager's struggle between the omerta of his sex shop and doing the right thing played out in the seconds of silence. He gnawed at a fingernail. Kate let him stew. Finally, he looked up and said, Yes, he came here occasionally. Started a couple of years ago. I looked up his card when I saw his face in the paper. We don't use real names here. Members prefer it that way. But I knew the face. It was 2006 he started coming. Another member brought him. Mike Doonan? You said you wouldn't ask about anyone else. Anyway, as I said, no real names, but I think they worked together. Kate smiled at him. That's so helpful, thanks. Can you remember the last time he came? Are there any records? Hang on, Lenny said, and unlocked an ancient filing cabinet. He registered as 007, very smooth. No visits registered after September 6, 2006, until...